than they should be, than they need to be, simply because television news is just comes from Duluth. But I think in terms of trying to make the area more cohesive, I really don't think there's been that much impact. Some nights it's way above the show business. Some nights it's extremely informative. And some nights it's just, you know, some nights we're tremendously proud of what we do. Just tremendously proud of what we do. And other nights we know that we've just struck out all the way around and that we've, you know, that we haven't accomplished what we set out to do. Television news depends to some degree upon the cooperation that you're able to get from the people, because unlike pen and pencil reporting, once you get the guy to say it, you've almost always got to get him to say it again on film. And most of the time, when somebody has made a remark that embarrasses themselves, they certainly aren't going to repeat it for the benefit of the camera and for the whole world to watch them. So from that standpoint, unless you're capable of going out and shooting from the hip and doing the kind of spontaneous television journalism, which is really the only good journalism, you run into some very serious technical handicaps. And I guess that I would have to say that television is struggling. Sometimes it does a tremendously superior job, and sometimes it does a very inane and almost an uncomprehending job. It can get into stories that it cannot cover.
We've had economic problems in the area, and we're attempting to outline some of the problems, if nothing else, and to maybe point some directions for the future. Again, it's a responsibility we have to the area, because the area supports us and depends on us, and we, of course, are vitally interested in seeing health and growth and good economy, because it improves our position. We might get a raise.
There's a lot of things wrong in this country, and I think that journalism has an obligation to try to point those out, and that's why you see so much bad news on television, is because what is right about the country is good, and it's evident to people. Well, what is wrong sometimes is hidden and is really an abrasive factor in breaking down certain elements within our society. And I think that if we're going to survive in this kind of a society, we've got to make some changes. And journalism is the chronology of the change that has to be made.
Where are we going? Goodhue's early journalistic efforts were pointed mainly in the direction of territorial growth and something called progress. And while newspeople in all of today's media speak of working for change and pointing direction, their goals are not much more long-range than his were a century ago. But Bill Weir of Community Information Systems at Jonathan in Carver County has done some serious crystal ball gazing. Cable television, he believes, will radically alter not only the amount and kinds of communication available to Minnesotans, but the very structure of the society in the state as well.
Oh, there's an information overload already, as you well recognize. And the information overload comes in part by our being given information that is irrelevant to us too much of the time. When we move into this era of two-way cable, in combination with microwave and satellite, people will be able to use this powerful communications instrument to select the communications they want when they want it. It can put them in touch with other people as part of a meeting, in a sense, an electronic meeting, if you will, not just a conference telephone call, but going beyond what you can do over that narrow band of a telephone line into what visual communications makes possible, where you're able to respond to one another almost as we do now, side by side. There's a sense of really being there. And each one of these locations where you can originate on the cable will almost be like a window onto an opening onto the entire world, a kind of magical room like the Wizard of Oz might create. The world changes with the advent of this new communications tool. It can be used, I think, to tyrannize if we ignore the opportunities that cable provides through its abundance of channels for public access, for all kinds of educational, library access, services beyond what any of us have thought of yet. We're trying to do that kind of forethinking, that futuristic work, bringing it down to earth in the work of community information systems at Jonathan and elsewhere, to find out what is really cost-effective now and what people want in the way of the use of this powerful instrument, the cable. The future may bring it into our homes, our offices, our clinics, our schools, a place of not just George Orwell's telescreen. On the contrary, it will be a place where we originate what we want. It may be at the beginning just a digital origination, saying, I want number 2985, a program that's available to me on a channel that is reserved for this kind of call-up of a program when the person wants it. It might be a program that is merely entertaining. It might be last night's city council meeting, or some segment of it. It might be some information from a library that I need in order to complete the paper I'm researching right now. It might be some information I need in order to make a decision for my business. At first, yes, we will have to go to this, to the little simple little studio. It might be in the elementary school down the block. But eventually, we'll be able to plug a camera into any home outlet. Our state may be a great pioneer in creating that sense of place through the cable system that makes people feel I've got an opportunity to get what I need to surround my life with what fulfills life, what gives me a handle on changing things the way I think they ought to be changed, or at least participate in that process. It radicalizes the sense of neighborhood, the sense of region, and it makes possible the creation of a more realistic sense of what our place is.
Norman Cousins, writing in Saturday Review, October 24th, 1970. The significance of communications has seldom been more pithily expressed than in Aristotle's comment that the size of a political unit is determined by the range of a single man's voice. He was thinking, of course, of the Greek world, where all the citizens of a city-state such as Athens could assemble in one place and attend to their common affairs. According to this yardstick, the entire world today is a potential single community. There is no part of the globe that is not within the range of a single man's voice. music from the album Stockhausen, electronic music on the DGG label. And special thanks to George Hagee for reading from his book, Newspapers on the Minnesota Frontier, published in 1967 by the Minnesota Historical Society. A Sense of Place was written and produced by Claudia Daly for Minnesota Educational Radio under a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. Engineering by Glenn Owen. The distance between an apartment complex in Bloomington and Ely on the edge of a 2,000-mile wilderness stretching through northern Minnesota and on into Canada can be covered in about 5 hours by automobile. But is it possible by any mode of transportation to span the psychological distance?
There's something strange, something remarkably forceful that gets people who once lived in the North. I suppose part of the reason is that the North still has a sense of wilderness. The wilderness is disappearing fast here, but the further north you go, there's more wilderness. The only place where people live in this country called the North is along its southern fringe, say 200-300 miles from the Canadian-U.S. border. Beyond that, there are only occasional mining camps, clusters of natives, some logging operations. But all of that vast country denotes something in this day when we think about being crowded and pushed around and not having space enough for our own needs. So space expands. Open country, wilderness, whatever name you want to give it, is a great drawing card. That's one part of it. And then there's the matter of silence.
I think that your reference to retreat to nature is very appropriate here, because first of all, I think this is a International Village is a community within a community. I think that the people here need other people, like Mike said about being very gregarious. And they're looking for something, just like maybe a small town might provide. It's within. And yet they can have that urban atmosphere, they can go downtown in Minneapolis and go to all the nightclubs, they can go to the strip and go to all the nightclubs. They can have the best of both worlds here. And I think their needs.
The difference between living in a bustling little town in the middle of the desert as different to living in, say, Sacramento, where you're an hour from the mountains, an hour from Frisco, you're an hour from the woods. In a place like this, everything is accessible and nearby. It takes no effort to reach any part of the world that you want to be in. And you may forget some worlds, like, again, artistic qualities and that type of thing. And very few artists, I think, are out here. The type of artist that sits and paints creatively. A lot of commercial artists, definitely, but very accessible here. Anything you want to do, if you want to be with any kind of a person, I think they're right here, and they're at fingertip. And I think they're receptive, I think they're right. I think they're doing the same thing, they're willing to meet you, any basis that you want to call. Maybe superficial, may possibly develop into something far deeper.
A Sense of Place, a documentary series which looks at regions and regionalism in the state of Minnesota, produced by Minnesota Educational Radio under a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. This program is called More Than One Wilderness. We are a society on the search, and a state whose goals are polarized between progress and preservation. Hardly more than a century since Pig's Eye and St. Anthony were scruffy river settlements, Minnesota is proud of the beauty, the culture, the industrial success of its twin cities and their suburban appendages. And the pride is justified. Minneapolis and St. Paul are rich in many ways, especially so in relation to the decay evident in most major metropolitan centers the country over. Up north, however, the state possesses another kind of treasure. Mile upon mile of forest land, decorated with gleaming lakes and sinuous rivers. Silent country, except for some noisy small-town chambers of commerce. Largely uninhabited, except by some rugged individuals who like it that way. This, then, is a point of tension in our state. Its personality split between the social needs of its outgoing, gregarious metropolitan self and the deeper explorations of its soul region, delicately balanced, dependent on space and silence for survival. This is a story of people searching for their place in this state, those who chose or were chosen by the city, and those whose commitment has taken them northward in geographical direction, inward in psychic terms. It begins at International Village, an apartment complex in Bloomington.
When I first came to International Village, I felt strange, as though, you know, I were the only one who had survived an A-bomb attack, because I just wasn't at first meeting people as much as I, you know, wanted to, I guess. You have a little bit of loneliness when you first come to a new place.
Nancy Kuhl is an overseas teacher for the Arabian American Oil Company, working this year on an exchange basis at a grade school in Edina. She's been out of the country for a dozen years, most of them spent in Saudi Arabia.
You know, we live in a vacuum over there, and you feel very deprived of current news, keeping up with the times. And I just wanted to be sure I was in a place that was swinging somewhat, you know. So I had friends that were looking out for a place that might be good for a single person. And they sent me this brochure that I thought just sounded, you know, wow, that's for me. The International Village brochure. So I wrote in right away and told them my situation. I was interested in living there for 1 year. And, you know, when you live abroad, why, letters have a lot of meaning for you. And I got a letter from the secretary at that time. It was Sharon Shunk. And she says, we've assigned you to such and such a room, and I think you'll like it. And just those reassuring words, you know, coming to a strange city that I thought, with this brochure and with that secretary, I think this is really what I want. Plus, I'm interested in sports, and, you know, that advertises tennis and golf and the rec center and a swimming pool and all. And compared to what I'd had, I thought, you know, this just couldn't be beat.
I've always been very people-oriented, and I do love working with people. So I enjoy it very much. I have, as you know, many, many people to work with, and they're from all walks of lives. And many people are from the foreign countries, and you just have to remember to smile in any language.
Lucy Hedelstadt is officially the rental manager for International Village. In truth, she's something of a house mother to the people who live there. For this is an apartment complex different from most others that dot the landscape in the Twin Cities, a difference you can see in the handsomely designed buildings, each with a touch of continental flavor set among rolling green areas, a difference Lucy believes people who come to live there can feel and respond to enthusiastically.
I think basically they come and they're just looking for an apartment, or possibly they want to be with the type of people they feel they want to be with. Some people really don't know what they want, but it ends up that they find it there. And the philosophy of the man who built the place was to build a way of life. He just does not believe in building apartments and collecting the rent check. His philosophy is that many apartment people are very lonely people. So we try to give them a way of life. And they seem to find it there and get together. It's like a community. So this is what we have there, we feel. And we have many social activities and athletical activities going on at the village. So if they don't have friends, they do meet them, whether it's at their job, at the village, or whatever, you know, they decide to do. But they do find themselves going out less and less.
Okay, I had my choice, and I'd known people from the village before. In other words, when I first came on the police department, I moved to several homes, and then I knew a couple people that lived here and their girlfriends lived here, so I used to come down on Sunday afternoons and got to know a couple of people out at the pool. They have pretty big to-dos every Sunday with a band and big crowd. It gets pretty crowded out there. In so many words, I picked this place because I thought it was less phony.
Mike Jennings is 24, a policeman on the Bloomington City Force. Once married and soon to be again, he met his new fiancée at the village. But, he suggests, people shouldn't come to the suburbs with that goal in mind, as relationships are apt to be of the more casual variety.
You live in Minneapolis. You're a mundane secretary or clerk or not real happy with your job. You're trying to make things better, and you hear from people, Bloomington is really fantastic. There's parties all the time. The whole strip is covered with hotels and restaurants and nightclubs you can go to and meet a number of people. Why don't you move out there? It's fantastic out there. So here's a person who's accustomed to, say, a lower city form of life. They come out here to meet the person that they've always been waiting for, like they have been thinking back in Minneapolis. It's not like that. They come out here and they meet the first guy that comes along, and he's just comes at her all together, you know, just seems like he's totally in love with her. One night, you know. Well, the next day it's gone. You know. Mainly it's just you get together to have a good time. And I think that's a part of lifestyle in Bloomington. There's a lot of people getting together just to have a good time with no looking back. Tomorrow, it'll be all together different tomorrow. You meet a girl out here. Let's have a fantastic time tonight. Whatever you choose to do, we'll do. If it happens to be sex, fine. If it's not sex, fine. Let's go have a good time. And tomorrow, you'll think about it. Maybe you'll call her again, maybe you won't.
You can sense the interim, or going on to other things, or transition before they get married, transition before possibly they make more money and they can get their own apartment, they don't have to share it with someone. The middle-aged people, they've sold their home, they stay, they're very stabilized. The only reason they would leave is if they really wanted a change of scenery. Apartment people sometimes are transient to the point where they like a new look or a sunken living room or whatever. But basically, like I say, it's the younger people when they're just starting out, possibly get married. Some stay on, some don't. But I would say, really, that it would maybe even out 60-40. 60% in the transient or interim of their period of life, and the others are very stabilized and stay for a long period of time. We've got tenants that have been here 7 years. A lot of the people that are older wouldn't leave the village because they've got the youth around them that they enjoy, and it does keep them young. You will see them always out at the pool every Sunday or every night, conversing, being with the young. They really need this. I tell many young people, they come to rent there, they like it, and they want to be with this, and they want to rent there, but they feel that it's too expensive, like maybe $10 to $20 a month over what the budget was that they had planned for themselves. So I tell them to think about it, but that they will end up saving that $10 to $20 a month in entertainment. First of all, they won't be going out as much. Secondly, they will be bringing their friends there to entertain them. So this way, you know, they save a lot, and it becomes much more economical than they had anticipated when they first looked at the overall picture of so-and-so X amount of dollars for an apartment. So it's all in what they're looking for, I feel. Again, they don't know, some of them, yes, but they do find out in a hurry when they get there. I would have a sense of living in a smaller community in a wild wilderness, and it is an escape. And you're with people that basically, I think, feel the same way. They can get back, shut their door, it's very quiet there if they want it to be. But if they want the excitement, or maybe not excitement, just someone else to talk to, someone else to put a steak on the outdoor grill with, it's there. you will see kids walking hand in hand, a blanket in the arm, or they'd be laying out on the grass. Now, there's not too many apartment complexes where you see this. You basically see parking lots and garages. And it's a feeling of freedom, like you say, with nature. They can actually walk out and touch it or be on the grass or, you know, whatever. There's flowers planted around, as you notice. The shrubbery is beautiful. I think it's all there.
I soon became, in my own, I guess, feeling as though I belonged, you know, and people began to speak, and you do feel odd when you go in the rec center at first, and everybody seems to know everybody, but you don't. Or you go to a party, and everyone seems to know everybody, and you don't know them, but it has fulfilled my needs very well, and I find that, you know, I really hate to leave. No, it's like a small town, pretty much, you know. You get to know the people in your building, and the village does have these social things that bring you together also, and it seems like a small community. Oh, I definitely think this type of living is the coming thing. I think what I visualize are villages within themselves, totally self-sustaining, you know, with their own little grocery store where you can get anything you need, and you'll hardly need to go outside the village. You know, we already have a hairdresser on our block, and I believe that more and more it'll be a community within a community, you know, from now on, because it's such a popular way to live.
It's normally fast, but I think you can step out of it. The average person out here, they're probably more salesmen than anywhere. I don't, on this side of the city, where the most of the apartment complexes are, I think you've got a faster moving people, the salesman, maybe the pilot, the stewardess, the secretary, the successful this and that, but they're not making $100,000 a year. You know, they're in a middle income bracket, maybe even a lower middle income bracket. And those people, you move fast for the money you're making, you know. But you can step out, you've got your jobs. You've got to work at your jobs to stay here. These aren't people that have already made it, they're people that are making it. Therefore, you might have a great fast time for 3 days over the weekend. During the week, you step out, you're back in your job, you're working 8 to 5, you're slowing down, you're having dinner with your friends, you know, maybe you're the guys you work at with the company, things slow down. But if you want to ever get back into it, there's no end to what you can, no end to what you can get into. You've either got to be the way your peers are out here, or be able to develop into being that way. You've got to be more or less sociable. You've got to be outgoing. You've got to want to do strange things. You've got to want to be busy a lot of the time. And if you're not, because a lot of the people around you are, it's easy to have you overlooked. And if you're overlooked, you know, it's pretty lonely, you know. If you're out here for that purpose, and I think a lot of people are, to have a good time, and you're not, and you see everybody around you that is, that's lonely, you know. I describe myself as someone, and you'd laugh, but I describe myself as something that's basically shy. I really do. I think of myself like that. Yeah, I think of myself as, when I start something, I may put on a front to act confident so that I'm more easily accepted. But it's not until I'm accepted that I feel at all confident. And out here, when you're developing so many relationships on so many different levels, every time you start one, I feel like you're... I'm very unconfident until, out here.
I think that's why you're here, Mike, is because the village provides that opportunity for you to meet people. It provides the opportunity where you can be accepted. And I think there's a certain type of person that lives here in the village. And it's the person that needs to be accepted by others. It's a person that's maybe hassled by the hubbub and the rapid movement of an urban society, and here he can come in and retreat, he can be alone if he wants to, and yet there's, like Mike said, there's opportunities to congregate with others and be accepted. And I think you get that congregation of lonely people, and they have a good time.
Do you think people out here are really lonelier than, say, other areas?
Yes. I think they're looking for something. And I think the people that move out of here are people that perhaps thought this lifestyle was something they wanted and just never could adjust.
And when people can't adjust, can't fit themselves into a city lifestyle, no matter how comfortable the amenities, how outgoing the company around them, sometimes they choose another kind of trip, northward and inward. Naturalist author Sigurd Olson and University of Minnesota sociologist George Donahue offer differing views of what that journey means to Minnesotans and the larger society as well.
Up at my home in Ely, we have a constant stream of young people who come through. But these young people say this: we don't want to make a lot of money. We want our work to have more meaning.
The seventh sense of place continues on side two.
We want to live closer to the earth. We have a certain reverence for life, for all living things. I still don't mind taking checks from Mama and Papa, the hated establishment, but that's because I'm on the way to my full realization, and they know it. But there are countless thousands of these young people, I would say hundreds of thousands of young people, who have developed a new lifestyle, a new attitude toward the earth, a new matter of priorities, a new matter of trying to find work that's meaningful to them, and that the evolution of the mind and the spirit is far more than the idea of getting a good job with fringe benefits and security in the offing. I'm convinced that the American people, and I might just as well say the people of the world generally, are going through a cultural revolution. Never before have people felt the way they do now towards the world in general. Never before have they been so disturbed about the environmental crisis. Never before have they realized that the lives that they are heading toward may not have the meaning and the fulfillment that they hope. Of course, there are many factors. Our long war, three long wars, the fact that there are so many discordant elements in our society, the loss of the old integrities, the old values, and so on. They realize this, and they want to do something with it. And I say, thank God.
One reason this draws such notoriety is because it's so infrequent, you know, because if it were the common everyday thing, what? It wouldn't gain that notoriety. As a matter of fact, if it became common, a common everyday activity, then the social structure would have changed rapidly in the country as a whole. And if it does become quite frequent and threatens the existing structure, you might say you'll see the same struggle between the existing industrial democracy and this type of behavior as you see between the agrarian democracy and the development of the industrial democracy. The fight between the small town and the large metropolitan area is evidence of the switch that we've gone through. Now, if we begin to switch back, you'll see a similar struggle. But right now, I think it's there's a lot of frustration. It may be an individual case here and there. And it sort of points up for the people when they look at it, this nostalgic. Oh, they live through the place that adventures. They read it in the paper and say, gee, isn't that great? and they sort of get a vicarious satisfaction out of it, in a sense. They may want to go there, or they may not want to go over there, but you see, we always get vicarious satisfaction out of reading what someone else has done, whether it's Perry at the North Pole or Plaistead at the North Pole, or whatever happens to be the case. And there are those individuals who will go out and indulge in that type of activity and provide this vicarious satisfaction for the rest of us.
Cultural revolution, or an exception that proves the rule and provides the rest of us with vicarious satisfaction. People trying to create a new life in the wilderness are not likely to view their venture in terms of its broad societal implications. For them, it's a personal matter.
I think we've both been interested in a long time. For a long time in living in the woods. I know I moved up here about 4 years ago, and so did Cassandra. I know I started looking down back roads the first year I was here, you know, hoping I'd find a little homestead or something like that. And I sort of moved up here with the idea of staying here for a long time. And I liked, the main reason I moved up here was I knew about the countryside here and the beauty and somewhat the isolation I liked and the ruggedness in a way and the fact that there aren't too many people around. So I just have always had that in the back of my mind. Although we didn't really get started with it, or I didn't really get started with it until Cassandra, or get to the point of actually buying or bidding on a piece of land until Cassandra was interested. And she was very determined one summer, and so we hunted around and talked about buying land together a lot, went through many ups and downs, and finally decided to buy it. And from that point on, began to make plans that suited this kind of land, this piece of land, because before you get a piece of land, you hardly know what you're going to end up with.
Kristen Nelson and Cassandra Sterry own a piece of the backwoods north of Duluth. They bought it at auction a couple of years ago. This summer, they'll be building a cabin from some old barn lumber they were told they could have for free if they would just tear the thing down and haul it away.
The design of the actual building sort of is determined by the lumber that we found as far as the size. And I don't think we're really being that experimental with our design, basically, but we are going to try to have very well-planned space for what we do have. And Cassandra has read a lot, and we've both done a lot of talking. People. We both have friends who've done something like this or are thinking about doing it. Or, you know, there are a lot of people now, especially young people who are moving out into the woods. So there's a lot of information if you just want to spend the time talking to people. And local people are, you know, been out in this area a long time are really helpful too. They can tell you shortcuts and stuff like that that you can't really read about in a book. Or like here, it's kind of unique when the frost goes so deep, you know, how do you plan a foundation? And I think the local people have been more helpful than books. In the meantime, we have a teepee, which we lived in last summer, and planning on living again this summer, and maybe other summers too, even when the building's up. And right now you can see it really in front of you here, in various bits and pieces, because we have just started putting it up. We moved it again this year. Last year we set it up, and we found out, even though we set it up in the highest part of this clearing, it was one of the wettest areas when it rained. So we moved it to a place that had better drainage, which was closer to the bottom of the clearing. And then last summer, if you remember, there was so much rain. The last night I slept in it, my air mattress floated through the door. There's a lot of strength in a teepee too. You know, the cone shape. We went through some pretty strong winds last summer, some pretty bad storms, and
you really feel good in a teepee because it just doesn't, you know, a regular tent is flapping and everything feels like it's going to fly away, but the teepee really feels strong. And there's a rope that comes down, it's tied to the poles where they all cross at the top. And it's staked into the ground, you know, so there's further, besides the cone shape, there's more ways of anchoring it down. It's really nice to have a fire in it too, which is something you can't have in a regular tent, you know. That's a very, many's the night. That was a thing we looked forward to after, you know, cooking our supper.
That's
walking down to the teepee and lighting the fire, and we have an apple orchard. This place was homesteaded a long time ago, and they planted about 20 tree orchard, and it hasn't been tended for years, so when we pruned it the first year, we took all the prunings, and that wood is used for our teepee fires. It smells very good, and it doesn't smoke very much. It's really nice wood. I have a lot of good expectations from last summer, you know, but I feel a little uncomfortable now because I'd rather the teepee were up, and I don't have to go through that sometimes. You have to put it up several times before it hangs right. And I just feel kind of lazy today. I'd just rather sit and lie in the sun or something like that. I feel a little awkward and somewhat impatient. There's sort of a much more peaceful, relaxed feeling that you get when you've been out in the country for a while. And I notice, like, as soon as we plan on going to the city on a day, our attitude seems to change and our whole tempo changes, and it just is a lot less natural feeling or something. Right now I would like money mainly not so much for myself, so I'll eat enough. You know, I don't feel like I'm going to starve or anything like that. And taxes are very cheap out here. And this place doesn't demand money at all. You know, it demands time. Mostly I just want money so I can get the equipment I need to make pottery. You know, that's because that's a really important thing to me. We're hoping the building will only cost us about $400 by the time it's done. That's probably somewhat low estimate, I don't know. Maybe it's just right. But I don't know, what else is there that we need money out here for except to feed ourselves and to carry out whatever projects, you know. There's a number of things we certainly could do. Could build a high-rise apartment. Yeah. Well, I think the strongest thing it means to me is that it means I have a place of my own, and it doesn't. That's immediately what getting the land sort of gave me, a sense of place of my own, place where I could do things. Try things, you know, and have goals and stuff like that that I set up. And that felt really good, a lot of security in that for me. But I found over the past year that I don't think this place will really feel, you know, secure to me year-round, especially until we have the cabin up, because the teepee isn't practical to live in the rest of the year, and we really aren't out here much when it turns colder, because there really is no good shelter here, and it's fairly exposed. And I think that'll change a lot, what the meaning of this land is to me, as soon as the building's up. I can think about it, but the feeling, I think, once the cabin is done, I'm thinking will be a lot different. I really, for me it means place where I can go, where I can get away from people. That's a lot of it, you know. It's isolated and it's private, because privacy means a lot to me. And it's a place where I can do things with trees and plants, because I really like doing that, you know. And I usually have lived in rented places where you can't do much, you know. It's also a place where I can do pottery, because often if you make pots in town, you've got fire wardens to contend with and all kinds of people, you know. I'm a pretty independent person, and I think I, you know, this kind of place fits in with me. It's sort of like paradise to me, except it's not really, because it's a real place, and there's a beautiful apple orchard, but there's bears that come and eat all the apples and break all the branches. So my fairy tale world has shattered, you know. Cities mean noise to me and action, you know. It's more action than I generally like handling, on the one hand. On the other hand, it means kind of exciting things. Interesting people, or maybe new people to meet. And right now, you know, I was living in a commune for the last 2 years, and I just moved out of that. And I have no more city home anymore. This is my home now. And that, I'm sort of thrown off kilter by that right now. I'm just sort of, boy, this is it. And what is the city going to mean for me now on, from now on? You know, what is it going to, what part is it going to play in my life? I don't really know.
We've forgotten what natural rhythms are. That people aren't supposed to move that fast. But the North still has these cosmic rhythms. I think of what Bertrand Russell wrote. Speaking of cosmic rhythms, he said, if you can develop a cosmic sense, then all of the little irritations of life, all the trivia, can be lived with. If your cosmic sense is broad enough so that you can look at the earth and look at the universe and look at mankind and yourself, then so many of the little things that drive us up the walls aren't so important anymore.
Music from the albums Environments, Disc 2 on the Atlantic label, and Tapestry by the Electric String Ensemble on Columbia. Comments by Sigurd Olsen from a speech at Scholastica College in Duluth during the Humanities Forum, Spring 1973. A Sense of Place was written and produced by Claudia Daly for Minnesota Educational Radio under a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. Engineering by Glenn Owen.
The thing which differentiates a small community and its lifestyle from a large town or an urban area is probably the importance of people. Everybody in a small town is necessary and is important and contributes to other people's welfare. In an urban area, there are 20 people waiting in line for everybody's job or scrambling to get ahead. I think people who understand and are able to accept the importance that they must assume in small town life are the ones who do it successfully. And this, I think, is going to be, it's going to be interesting to see if it really does help us keep doctors and other professionals in that role throughout more of their life.
It certainly makes a difference as to whether you have an appreciation if he's a baker or a farmer or a car dealer, or what this man is involved in what his family style and what his his previous lifestyle was like before he came to have the condition. And can we improve or retain the quality of this person's life? Well, you've got to know what that quality was and how he viewed that, his expectations. And so, yes, definitely you can know your patients better from that viewpoint, know what their expectations are with regard to the quality of life, because I know back in the larger hospitals in the cities, a very important part of the history and physical on a hospitalized patient is a social history or a patient profile or whatever you want to call it, where you attempt to get some insight into the patient's views and expectations regarding lifestyle. And this oftentimes, though, it just comes across verbally, and there are many different ways of communicating. And if you can communicate on various levels and communicate at different times, not just one setting like in a hospital, and know this patient, you can know so much more about what he expects out of life, what how he views life, what his lifestyle is. And knowing that, then, you can help him manage his disease or his condition to a point to attain as closely as possible a lifestyle that's compatible with his expectations, so there won't be anxiety produced when this isn't met.
I'm interested in working where there is a need for physicians, for primary care, and so I know there are many needs in Minnesota, and it most likely would be a rural area, some place where they have a shortage of physicians or are unable to keep or maintain a physician.
I think that practicing in a small town is going to have problems, but practice anywhere is going to have problems. And it's just, it depends on what problems you're willing to take. You go into a city where there's lots of doctors, and there's problems there too. You know, you may not have a big variety of patient types. You tend to go into specialties, and if that's what you want, you know, I suppose that would be the kind of thing to go into. But there's a real need for family practitioners, and it's really challenging. It's much more challenging. Most people really admit that they go into specialties because they're a little afraid, or would go into specialties because they're you know, a little fearful of the variety of things to that they would have to know as a family practitioner.
A Sense of Place, a documentary series which looks at regions and regionalism in the state of Minnesota. Produced by Minnesota Educational Radio under a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. This program is called The New Doctor on Old Main Street.
The problem is, when you get there, you have an appointment, usually, and the waiting problem. I like to see if I have an appointment to get there and let's get the job taken care of and not wait an hour or 2 hours. We had this problem about 3 years ago when our son broke his arm and had to be taken to a specialist at St. Cloud. There were instances where we waited 2 hours before we saw the doctor.
And you can't really afford to lose that kind of time.
Not on the farm. I mean, I don't say anything because I felt that he's a busy man too. But when you do visit him, he's at ease. And he just puts in his 8 hours, and I imagine probably once or twice a week he's an emergency call. And in this situation, these doctors were in a group. There was more than one involved. So I felt that they are so far behind, why doesn't the next man pitch in and help him along?
A Stearns County farmer voices some of the annoyances Minnesotans, both city dwellers and small town people, experience when they seek medical care. And valid as these complaints are, we are in a way fortunate to be able to make them. Because in a lot of places in this country, many places even in this state, you can't complain about how long you sat waiting in the doctor's office. There's no office to sit in. No doctor to see. Physicians just haven't been locating in rural areas lately. Dr. Robert Carter, Dean of the Medical School at the University of Minnesota, Duluth.
The medical school here in the Duluth campus of the university was started by the regents, the university administration, and the legislature to try and do some very specific things. For many years, there has been a shortage of doctors in the rural parts of Minnesota. The metropolitan area has about two-thirds of the doctors to serve half the population. One-third are left for the other half of the people in Minnesota. In addition to the shortage in absolute numbers, there is a very severe shortage in several types of doctors. This is most marked in the people doing general medicine or family practice. The number has been declining year after year in all parts of the country. Minnesota is no exception, and it's reached really critical proportions. The regents and the president of the university and everybody hoped that this program could both learn more about training people for this type of practice and could expand the total production of doctors by the university.
By 1980, close to 400 freshman medical students entering training each year will be needed to meet the demand for physicians in Minnesota and to approach a solution to the problems of health care for rural parts of the state. Where those young people will come from and the kinds of educational experiences that will be provided them are questions being considered today in programs like the one at the Duluth campus and in the Rural Physicians Associate Program, which is operated out of the Family Practice Department of the University in Minneapolis.
First of all, we have to have students who are intellectually able and well prepared to do graduate work. There is no substitute for intelligence and proper application of this in a health science. In addition to this, however, we're looking at certain characteristics within people which we hope are going to be important. For example, we know there has been a great migration of people from rural areas into urban areas in this whole country for many, many years. Fascinatingly, there has been really no counter-migration. People born in the urban areas almost never go back to a rural area for a prolonged period of residence or work. There are a few exceptions, of course, but the odds are overwhelming that the people who stay in a rural area started there, or at least had some early experience in their life which showed them what it was like. Many of the things in life, you know, that we do too late. And as I think Joseph Conrad said in Laura Jim, there's never time to do the last thing or say the last word in anything that you're going to do. Never, I think, is this more true than in a person's training. If you start too late, or if you count on last experiences, they more often than not fail. As with our children, our own children, we simply don't realize that much of your life pattern is established very early in your life. What you feel comfortable with, what you understand, and what you feel has value are things which you experienced either as a preschool child or in your earlier years in school. Many of them, of course, were values which your parents transmitted to you consciously and often unconsciously. For this reason, we are very much interested in attracting people into this program who have had early experience in what life in a smaller community is really like. These are the young men and women who will understand it, and these are the people who can participate in it and do so comfortably. It is true that as knowledge increases as rapidly as it has been, that we are seeing very, very strong forces towards specialization in every profession. school teaching, chemistry, medicine, so forth and so on, engineering. It is equally true that we must retain generalists in all professions. Otherwise, you have such a fragmentation of service and so little communication between specialists that the patient is in a hopeless maze. They really don't know how to sample or partake of things. The real issue appears to center around what you can educationally do to keep a person as a generalist. You must not only start with the right raw material, but you must do everything you can to properly train them for this role. I think this is basically the university's interest in this program. It's an experimental learning model to find out as much as we can, under very carefully controlled circumstances, how to do this job of education. We may not succeed, but we surely are going to know why we failed very well if we do fail in finding an important advance in this. I think, though, we probably will succeed more than we will fail. And it's already becoming apparent that anybody, be they a radio engineer or be they a professional actor or actress or this, maintains a general role if they have a strong feeling of competence and ability in themselves, confidence in what they are doing. It has to be realistic. They can't think they do things they can't. But a realistic self-esteem and confidence in their ability permits somebody to play a broader role. So what we're doing with these students is making sure that they learn under as good circumstances as we can the real concepts of the basic science they must apply to patients, and that they will come out of this knowledgeable practitioners, confident in their knowledge and willing to use it in a broader field of application.
Part 8 of A Sense of Place continues on cassette number 5.